What is the risk of autism spectrum disorder in offspring of women who use acetaminophen during pregnancy?
Raising potassium levels to prevent irregular heart rhythms.
What has been the impact of canceling federal funding for clinical trials?
And is an mRNA flu vaccine effective?
That's what we're talking about this week on Double T Health Watch, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a Baltimore-based medical journalist.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of Texas Tech Health El Paso.
Rick, before we begin recording on our studies for this week, let's just mention that the BMJ has issued an expression of concern for a study we talked about a couple weeks ago. We also expressed concerns about this study and about different methods that were employed in it. It was using stem cells in folks who had had an MI to try to see if they could stave off frank development of heart failure. So let's just tell everybody that, gosh, we were concerned and the BMJ is concerned, so probably not a good time to be making any kind of clinical decisions based on that study.
Yeah, the results seem too good to be true, especially based upon previous studies. So we were a little bit wary of it, and there'll be some more investigation done. Maybe we'll report on that investigation later on.
Okay. Why don't we turn first to the New England Journal of Medicine, and you can take it away.
Let's tee up the one about influenza vaccine. This will have real relevance to many of our listeners who make medical decisions based upon the studies. Among them, by the way, is a longtime listener, Jim Britton in New Mexico. Influenza vaccines are incredibly important. In 2022-2023 flu season, there were about 130,000 flu hospitalizations in the United States and more than 5,500 deaths. And that's just among adults between the ages of 18 and 64. Very young infants and older individuals with comorbidities are even at higher risk. So the recommendation is to receive annual flu vaccines. Unfortunately, the effectiveness of the flu vaccine ranges from about 10% to 60% because they try to predict which strain of flu will be active in the upcoming year. With the advent of COVID, we needed to develop vaccines very quickly that we could mass produce. The new technology to do that used mRNA. Can we apply the same technology to flu? So this was a phase 3 trial where they assigned healthy adults between the ages of 18 to 64 to receive either an mRNA flu vaccine or the standard flu vaccine. And this was conducted in the U.S., South Africa, and the Philippines. Over 18,000 participants, over 9,000 that received the mRNA vaccine and 9,000 that received the standard vaccine. They follow them over the course of the year. And what they found is that the mRNA vaccine was an additional 35% more effective in reducing laboratory confirmed flu. The mRNA vaccine was more reactive. It elicited more antibodies, but it also elicited local pain and redness, a little bit of fever and soreness, but nothing serious.
The mRNA, of course, someone has recently pointed out to me, this is something that our body is constantly making. And so we are already hardwired to respond to mRNAs in a way that ends up being effective. This same person pointed out that developing an effective vaccine that actually prevents infection with a respiratory virus is really difficult. The intention is to ameliorate the symptoms or reduce them to such an extent that they're insignificant from a clinical standpoint. So that and the fact that we can generate these vaccines quickly, in contrast to what normally takes place with the flu, says to me, hey, this is an idea whose time was yesterday.
Yeah, you're right. You can mass produce these, you can develop them more quickly, and they're less expensive. Even though it's more effective, if less people take it because of the side effects, it won't be nearly as effective. And Elizabeth, you and I both know individuals that say, well, every time I get the vaccine, I get the flu. They don't get the flu because there's not any active flu virus. They just have an immune reaction. So that's the trade-off.
I'm wondering if there are some strategies like prophylaxing with an NSAID or acetaminophen so that those are reduced and tolerable.
That's a great suggestion. They did not do this in this particular study because they didn't want to mask any side effects. But you're right. If you can prevent the side effects from taking a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug, that may be the best of all worlds.
Since I've mentioned acetaminophen, let's then turn to the study that's in the BMJ that is and what they call an umbrella review of systematic reviews of virtually all the information that's out there on maternal acetaminophen, or what they call it across the pond, paracetamol use during pregnancy, and the risk of autism spectrum disorders and also ADHD in offspring. They took a look at systematic reviews of randomized trials and cohort case control or cross-sectional studies that reported both this acetaminophen use by moms during pregnancy and diagnosis of autism or ADHD in their offspring. They had 9 reviews. They basically said, gosh, all of them showed that there was a relationship between the use of acetaminophen during pregnancy and the subsequent development of ASD or ADHD. However, when they looked at this more carefully, they found that their confidence in the findings of the reviews was low to critically low. They also took a look at sibling studies, and they found that this hazard ratio that was increased did not persist in sibling-controlled analyses for autism. So their conclusion is, hey, folks, the risk of having fever and the potential for poor outcomes in the offspring is higher without using it than it is with using it.
Yeah, and so you have mothers, some of whom take acetaminophen, some of whom don't. And then you assess whether those that took acetaminophen had a higher risk of having children with autism or ADHD. And if it looks like you do, you say, well, gosh, it must be due to the medicine. But there are other things going on as well. And one of the ways to control that is to look at their siblings that were subsequently born at a time when the mother did not take acetaminophen. And I'll be doggone, they also had a higher risk of ADHD and autism, which suggests that what drove it wasn't the medication, but it's either some genetic or environmental factors or socioeconomic factors. When you look at the sibling studies, it doesn't look like there's any association at all of acetaminophen with neurodevelopmental disorders.
I think this is a place where we can give women who are pregnant and who feel that they need to take acetaminophen some confidence that things are going to be just fine.
Right. And there are other medications, nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, that are contraindicated during pregnancy. Having a fever affects outcomes of babies, as does taking other drugs which could be harmful. And it doesn't appear that acetaminophen is one of those.
Let us rest on that and return to the New England Journal of Medicine.
Increasing or taking potassium to prevent irregular heart rhythms. The most concerning irregular heart rhythm is called ventricular tachycardia. We put in internal cardiodefibrillators in individuals that have had it before or at high risk, and these defibrillators will actually detect when ventricular tachycardia occurs and then shock the individual so that they don't die from the irregular heart rhythm. It's been known for a long time that having a low potassium level is associated with an increased risk of having ventricular tachycardia. So the question is, okay, let's take people that are at high risk, those that have had ICDs placed, and we know they're at high risk. Let's put them on a diet or a medication or potassium supplements that would raise their serum potassium. And can that prevent near fatal irregular heart rhythms? 1,200 participants, they had a normal serum potassium level. Half of these 1,200 patients just got standard care. The other half got put on either a mineralocorticoid or supplemental potassium, or just advice on dietary increasing of potassium. And they followed these individuals for about 3.5 years. And what they found is those in whom the potassium level was raised, and just modestly, it decreased the risk of having serious ventricular arrhythmias by about 25 or 30%. Were there any significant side effects? Actually, there weren't.
I'm wondering about in people who may have the comorbidity of compromised kidney function, the potential for hyperkalemia.
That's a great question. And in fact, one of the exclusion criteria is if people had significant kidney dysfunction, they weren't enrolled in the study.
I'd like you to comment on just sort of the general experience of low potassium levels among those of us just walking around free living, because there's a lot of that going on.
Yeah, so Elizabeth, it probably wasn't the fact that it raised some potassium. What it probably does is it prevents hypokalemia, low potassium.
So finally, let's turn to JAMA Internal Medicine, and this is a look at the clinical trials that have been affected by research grant terminations at the NIH. They took a look at active grants As of February 28, 2025, the date of the first reported grant termination, they wanted to examine trial characteristics, including anticipated enrollment, age eligibility, location, primary purpose, intervention type, phase, and primary condition of this clinical trial that was terminated. They have finally obtained their data on August 15th of 2025. In this interval, 385 or 3.5% of 11,000 plus clinical trials that were funded by NIH grants were subsequently terminated. A large number had been completed, 36%. 35% were recruiting participants who may have been in the process of receiving interventions. Over 74,000 of those folks had been enrolled in a clinical trial that was terminated. This, of course, violates the ethics of clinical trials. They also noted that a lot of these trials that were conducted outside of the US were disproportionately affected by this terminated funding. Similarly, in the Northeast, there was disproportionate impact. Prevention trials lost a lot of ground, and behavioral interventions also lost a lot of ground. Plus, those that were looking at infectious disease. It's sure looking like there was a lot of targeting relative to which grants were terminated.
Yeah, Elizabeth, this is very disturbing because we develop medications or preventive strategies to address conditions, and then we test them in large clinical trials to show whether it's effective or not and whether there are side effects. And you can't get halfway in a clinical trial or even complete it and not analyze it. And if you wasted time and money and effort, and you made a promise to these individuals that we're going to test this and these results will become available to know whether it's effective or not. We have violated that. To put it in perspective, we're talking about one in six infectious disease trials, one in 40 cancer trials, one in 20 cardiovascular disease trials. This is very disturbing.
Yeah, and I'm not sure that we can say anything other than we think these things should be restored.
Yeah, the NIH shutdown affected one in 30 trials. We need to restore those, and we need to make sure this doesn't happen again.
On that note, then, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthful choices.